10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
I am profoundly honored at the opportunity to be able to speak for the next few minutes on the morning show with Dr. George Archibald, who is co-founder of the International Crane Foundation, headquartered in beautiful Baraboo, Wisconsin. And this nonprofit organization, since the early 1970s, has been doing important and groundbreaking work in preserving endangered cranes, both here and around the world. The scope of the influence and good work of the International Crane Foundation, well, it really lives up to its name. And they have done incredible things and helped the whole world to better understand and appreciate these beautiful birds. And Dr. George Archibald has written extensively about his experiences, and most memorably in a book called My Life with Cranes, a collection of stories, and published by the International Crane Foundation. And I want to add that my father and stepmother saw Dr. Archibald speak, and they eagerly purchased his book, which he kindly autographed, and my dad shared this book with me and encouraged me vociferously to try to arrange this interview, which a few months ago was not easy to do because of Dr. Archibald's extensive travel schedule. His traveling right now, of course, is sharply curtailed, needless to say, because of COVID-19. So one silver lining of this unhappy situation is it makes it possible for me to be having this conversation with him. Once again, his book is titled My Life with Cranes, A Collection of Stories. He is now a senior conservationist with the International Crane Foundation. Again, he is a co-founder of this nonprofit and was its director for many, many years. Dr. George Archibald, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, I'm so happy to be speaking to the people in the Racine and Kenosha area. The Chiwaukee Prairie down in Kenosha is one of my favorite places, especially to see the prairie orchids. And in Racine, the Johnson family have been stalwart supporters and encouragers of the Crane Foundation from the very start. So we're very grateful to that family as well as all our members in your area.
Very
so
good.
It's nice to talk to you.
Wonderful. Could we just talk for a moment about COVID-19 and the fact that this has changed daily life for all of us? And I should think for somebody like you, who is accustomed to traveling far and wide, really kind of incessantly, from what I understand from your assistant, this must really feel strange to suddenly not be able to travel the country and travel the world in the way that you have been accustomed. How is life for you right now, and how is the work of the International Crane Foundation going forward during this time of COVID-19?
Well, in 2019, I was living out of the suitcase for 200 days. So during March, or January and February until mid-March, I was traveling in the U.S. So since mid-March, I've been home, and I've been thrilled to be home. I'm a gardener. I'm very involved in that. I'm studying a family of whooping cranes that are breeding in a marsh near Baraboo that they also share with four pairs of sandhill cranes that are breeding. So I did a study of them, or continuing to do that. And I'm writing a book called 40 Years in China to honor my deputy for many years and the head of our China program since 1987, Jim Harris, who passed away in September of 2018. So I'm very, very busy, and we have Zoom meetings with the ICF staff. Only the bird keepers are working at our headquarters, and the people who are putting finishing touches on our rebuilt visitor area. And the rest of us talk by Zoom every 2 weeks, and that includes our colleagues from Africa and Asia. So the world sort of shrank through COVID, not only through its contagion, but through our communication, which is now greatly facilitated in the electronic age, and showing us new and more effective ways of communicating. So I think, like everybody else, the COVID-19 has given us pause. It's given us time to catch up on things that were on the back burner, to be more with our families. And although it's a terrible infliction, especially to those that have been so seriously impacted, and our heart goes out to them. So we're holding our own. Our programs with our colleagues. Our colleagues, of course, are also impounded with various types of quarantine around the world. But they're gearing to get back out into the field, and step by step, getting back to the field is sort of easier than getting to a type of occupation in a city. So step by step, people are getting back into the field, and of course, cranes are fine, and because people have stayed indoors in many areas of the world, the cranes are likely a lot happier that they're not being bothered by people.
The irony. Under happier circumstances, or normal circumstances, what would people see if they were to visit the International Crane Foundation in Baraboo? And I should preface that by saying that I believe your visitor center has been closed and was poised for a grand reopening in late June, a reopening that, needless to say, has been postponed. But even apart from whatever this new visitor center looks like, what is housed at Baraboo that the general public has been able to enjoy under more normal circumstances?
Yes, there are 15 species of cranes in the world. In North America, we have the rarest of all cranes, the whooping crane, and the most abundant of all cranes, the sandhill crane. We exhibit those two species, and we exhibit pairs of all of the other species, 13 species, in beautiful exhibits with murals that bring you to faraway places. And we have a video theater where we talk about our programs around the world. And we have guided tours. The tours last maybe a couple of hours, starting off with meeting a tour guide, seeing the video, and then going out and experiencing all 15 species of cranes and the beautiful landscapes on our site, which are carpeted in prairie. There is part of our property, 250 acres, that's virgin prairie, and we've converted much of the rest of the former agricultural fields into one of the most beautiful prairies. So you learn a lot about Wisconsin, and you learn a lot about the world and its beautiful birds by visiting the Crane Foundation. Hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking to Dr. George Archibald, co-founder of the International Crane Foundation, a nonprofit headquartered in Baraboo, Wisconsin. They have been in operation since the early 1970s, and Dr. Archibald was a co-founder and the director of the International Crane Foundation until, I believe, right around the year 2000, and he still works with them as a senior conservationist. And we are talking in part about his book called My Life with Cranes, a collection of stories, a beautiful book that recounts many of the experiences that he has had over the years, both here and abroad. Dr. Archibald, one of the loveliest portions of the book is the what's almost kind of a preface called Early Days in Canada, in which you talk about your own childhood. I believe you were born in somewhere in Nova Scotia, Canada, and it was evident from very early on that you had a very special affection for and interest in birds. Tell us more about what this interest looked like very early on in your life.
Well, I was given a very special gift from the time I was an infant. Really, my first memories in life are all about birds. All of my first four memories are about birds, and I was a toddler then. And my parents recognized that this kid had this unusual interest, so they allowed me to have chickens, and I would stay with those chickens and watch them and study them. And as I grew up, so did my menagerie. Until I started university, I had to disperse the menagerie, and I thought, I'll become a doctor, and then I can save my pennies and have birds as a hobby, because I never thought you could make a living studying birds. My dad was a high school teacher, and they were very generous and with their slim resources and providing food for my many birds. So I knew that there was an expense to it. And so I was a pre-med student, but fortunately met a wonderful professor from Cornell University, Dr. William Dilger. And I had met cranes in Western Canada during summer jobs as an undergraduate and fell in love with cranes because we don't have them in Nova Scotia. We do now, but back then we didn't. And I just left my country and my medical school. I had been accepted at a very wonderful medical school, and I left everything and came to Cornell University to study cranes. And I studied international conservation issues there as well, and realized that many of the cranes might no longer be with us unless somebody did something to help them. And my colleague from Baraboo, Wisconsin, Ron Sally, and I got our heads together, and his dad had this little farm near Baraboo, and we decided to create an organization to help the cranes. First, by breeding the very rare cranes of Asia in captivity, because Asia was closed to us, the Iron Curtain with the Soviet Union, the Bamboo Curtain with the Cultural Revolution in China, and so many endangered cranes are there. So we collected birds from zoos all over the world on loan, and they sent them to Baraboo, and we applied our various techniques to get them to breed, and that was extremely successful. At the same time, we started studying cranes in the wild in Korea and in India, in countries in which we could work, and eventually started working in both Russia and China. And today, one of our largest offices is in Beijing, and we have a whole staff working on various problems in China.
Incredible.
So that's how it started.
It's amazing. One point you make as you describe your own emerging interest in birds when you were a young person, you make mention of something that I think would be interesting for our listeners to hear more about, and it has something to do with your eyesight. And I think this is one of the reasons why you ended up finding yourself drawn to larger birds like the crane. Can you just explain to our listeners what I'm talking about?
Well, I never realized I needed glasses until later on, and so I couldn't see the little birds very well. And then in university, they discovered that I was red-green colorblind, and that's why I would get mixed up so much with various thrushes and so on, where colors are very subtle. I love little birds, and I've learned how to compensate for my handicap and now have very good optical equipment to watch them. And together with a dear friend of mine from Bloomington, Illinois, on May 12th of this year, we saw 137 different species. To his credit, more than mine, but I enjoyed learning from him and seeing the little birds. So, I had a handicap when I was young, but I've overcome it, and now I'm really into warblers.
Very good. When it comes to cranes, I think, first of all, it would be helpful for our listeners to understand just sort of the scope of what we're talking about in terms of cranes. How many different kinds of species are there? Where do we find them in the world? And then we'll explore the story of a couple different kinds of cranes that are particularly endangered. But first, give us kind of a sense of just how many different kinds of cranes there are and where they are found.
There are 15 species of cranes, and the number of cranes on the various continents is proportional to the size of the continent. So the crane family evolved from North America. Their closest relatives are the limpkins that only live in Florida and in northern South America. But they spread into Asia, and today we have 8 species of cranes breeding in Asia and into Africa and into Australia. In Africa, we have 4 species. In Australia, we have 2 species, as we do here in North America. So the cranes, the underlying theme for all of them is that they require a lot of space and they require protection from humans in areas where there are a lot of humans. More and more, cranes are being compressed into very, very limited areas of grasslands and wetlands, which are vital to their survival. Fortunately, they also benefit from agriculture and will move into harvested fields to get earthworms and gleanings in many parts of the world. And in areas where the cranes are protected culturally, like Ethiopia and in Hindu parts of India, the cranes are strictly protected, as are all other birds. And they breed in little wetland patches or grassland patches in the midst of huge numbers of people. But the opposite of that is countries where cranes are shot and killed. Many of the Mideastern countries, crane killing is still rampant. And so on. Our challenge then is to work in areas of the world that are in greatest trouble for the cranes. And a lot of that has to do with education. If humans know what to do and have the proper values, the cranes and humans can live side by side very well if basic habitats are left for the cranes and not completely developed. So that's the general picture. They need wetlands, and they not only need wetlands during the breeding time, which is in the spring in the northern areas like Wisconsin, but they need them along a chain of wetlands leading to their wintering grounds in the south. For example, our whooping cranes breed way up in northern Canada, and they migrate almost 3,000 miles to winter in Texas. And now we're concerned about wind farms. They will not go within 5 miles of a wind farm. So if there are too many wind farms, there may not be many places for the cranes to land and rest. So that's the kind of issues we're dealing with worldwide.
Wow. And by their very nature, you are describing issues and concerns that are complicated and not easy to address. And I suppose in many cases we're talking about various constituencies that need to, in a sense, join together in addressing these kind of concerns.
Oh, yes. We're a small fish in a big pond. We have to work very closely with the huge international organizations like the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, and so on, in partnerships in various parts of the world. But we've been quite effective because we have a very clear objective, and people universally pretty much, know about cranes and want to help them. They're easy to see. They're huge. They're beautiful. You can hear their calls for miles. They dance. They're monogamous. They raise only one or two young every year. They lavish care on their young. So they've been embedded into the many cultures worldwide. There's lots of folklore about cranes, lots to build on when you're starting a conservation program, because you have a very charismatic species that embodies a whole ecosystem of other organisms in the wetlands and grasslands, in the watersheds, and the migration routes, and so on. So although it's very complicated, we have a very clear focus, and that's helped us plow through a lot of very difficult circumstances.
We're speaking with Dr. George Archibald, co-founder of the International Crane Foundation, and talking about his life and his work, and about his book called My Life with Cranes, A Collection of Stories. Dr. Archibald, I want to turn back in time one more time, because one of the things that I think is an important story is the story of what is known as the Cornell Cranium. And this, in a sense, was your first concerted effort to do something tangible to help cranes. And I should think, at least in many respects, this was kind of a starter kit for you, a learning experience which served you so well when you and your co-founder ultimately created the International Crane Foundation. And I appreciate so much the story of what this story represents in terms of a young person with very little experience, nevertheless having the guts and determination to create something out of nothing. Tell our listeners a bit about the story of the Cornell Cranium and what you think ended up being most valuable about that undertaking for you.
Well, the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology is the major research center for birds worldwide. And I was very honored to be able to start my graduate studies and complete them there from 1968 through 71. And Dr. Sewell Pettengill, a very, very famous ornithologist, hauled me into his office and says, I understand you're interested in getting cranes here at the laboratory. And he said, what do you know about cranes and keeping cranes, and what if something happens to them? It will look very bad for the Laboratory of Ornithology. Because he actually had been working on whooping cranes and their conservation when they were almost extinct. And I assured him that I had some experience working with cranes during the summer at the Alberta Game Farm that he never heard of, and that the old mink farm that was right beside the ornithology lab on Sapsucker Woods Road had been vacated. And my professor, Dr. Tom Cade, had made inquiries and said that the Department of Animal Science would let me use it for 3 years, but it would be demolished in December of 1971. So this was 1968. So I retrofitted the old mink farm and built fences and made ponds and wrote to zoos, mostly in the northeast of the United States, and was able to assemble 56 cranes of 8 species. I lived in the old office building with my dog, which wasn't heated, but I would go to the laboratory of ornithology for cleanup and commute it back and forth a bit, and had the time of my life. And some of the cranes started to breed. The reason it wasn't a conservation project at that time, it was a research project to document the language of cranes and to compare all the different species and to make an evolutionary tree of the crane family, which I succeeded in doing and which was later confirmed by DNA studies. So that was fun, figuring out where everybody fitted through their language, both visual and vocal, on the evolutionary tree of cranes. And at the same time I was taking these courses and the one on conservation biology really touched me deepest. And one of my very rare pairs of cranes, a pair of white-naped cranes, produced five young in 1971, my last year at Cornell. And it was because of that success that Ron and I had the idea, well, let's establish a center and breed these rare white-naped cranes and other rare cranes from Asia as a safeguard against species extinction. So I actually had a job offer from the New York Zoological Society to work on cranes or other birds indefinitely, and my first grant was to work in Japan. So I was able to work with them for about half a year, and then I got another grant to work in Australia on their cranes for half a year and came back to Wisconsin in 1972. Ron had and his family had built some enclosures for cranes, beautiful facilities, and we started to bring the birds in, and we incorporated as a nonprofit in 1973, thanks to the guidance of our local attorney, Forrest Hartman. And the three of us, Ron, Forrest, and I met every Wednesday night for 5 years during those early years of the Crane Foundation. Then we expanded our board in 1978, bought our own property, and rebuilt and opened in 1983 on our new site, which was only 5 miles away down the road from the Leopold Reserve. And that's our story.
One of the things that I find kind of amazing is, particularly when we come to this first effort, the Cornell Cranium, and also right at the outset with your own International Crane Foundation, is the fact that you as this young person would be entrusted with these precious endangered cranes. And there must have been something about you that would, you know, for instance, persuade the director of the Bronx Zoo to send off a couple of his own cranes from the zoo into your care and keeping. And I find that extraordinary. And I also find it extraordinary that you would feel equal to such a responsibility. I mean, these cranes were being entrusted into your care. And I should think at least some part of you had to be worried about whether or not you were going to live up to that responsibility and keep these cranes safe.
Well, I was all of 24 years old. And I'll never forget when I went into Mr. Conway's office. He was the director of the Bronx Zoo in New York, and explained my project. And he says, "Who the heck do you think you are? It requires a whole staff to look after these birds and so on." And he scolded me, very similar to Dr. Pettengill at Cornell. But we started chatting, and he said, "Well, I'll show you our cranes." And he spent the whole afternoon, and we walked all over the zoo, and we looked at every crane. And at the end of the day, I had 22 birds of 5 species. So I guess we clicked. And I think in life, personal relationships are what drive the whole thing. And if you have trust through such relationships, so I think I'm very sincere about what I do. I'm very dedicated to it. And people can feel that. So we've been successful. And, of course, that I just started this thing, and then now there are hundreds of people, and I think ICF has a staff of 140 people now around the world, and they're absolutely terrific. And my greatest comfort in life is having been part of starting the whole thing, and now there are much smarter people operating it. I'll never forget what Mr. Ford said about success. You always want to hire people that are smarter than you that you can trust. So I've been very happy to push off various responsibilities to wonderful people that can do things much better than I can. So I really rejoice in the great staff that we have, and I'm very thankful to our 9,000 members, most of whom are from the Midwest, that support our operation. It's a very expensive operation, as you can imagine.
Right. I do need to make mention of what is probably the single saddest moment in the whole history of the International Crane Foundation. And this occurred back in 1977-78 when quite a large swath of your population of cranes there in Baraboo fell seriously ill, and quite a number of them ultimately died from what up to that point was some kind of unknown disease. Can you just take us inside that moment? I should think it was exceedingly difficult and painful to experience that kind of loss.
It was totally painful. I had returned from Afghanistan on March 15th and walked out into a field where we had 40 or 50 younger cranes in the 10-acre compound. And this beautiful blue crane walked up to me and fell at my feet. And I picked her up, and she was very, very sick. And during the next 2 weeks, we lost 22 cranes from a formerly undescribed species of herpes virus that had been brought in with hooded cranes that were imported from China, actually. And they were resistant to this herpes virus, but the other species weren't. Fortunately, in 1973, the National Wildlife Health Lab was established in Madison, Wisconsin, and Milton Friend, the founder of the whole thing, and his staff had been monitoring our cranes from the start and advising us on management. And every year we did a health check and collected blood from all the cranes and had this log of serum frozen and were able to trace the virus back to the import of these hooded cranes. Well, half of our birds were contaminated with the virus, and we had to get rid of them eventually. So our site was contaminated. We had lost a lot of birds, not our rarest birds. None of the whooping crane Tex was okay, and the Siberian cranes that we just had imported from Russia were okay. But night and day for 2 months, I was looking after sick cranes, tube feeding them day and night, trying to keep them alive, not knowing what the disease was. And when you're under such circumstances, you have to concentrate just on the day you're in and not think about the big picture, because you just don't have the resources to do that, and mental resources especially. But eventually, the spring unfolded. No birds were sick, and we were back to sort of normal. And I brought together all of the people who had given more than $5,000 to the Crane Foundation. There were 23 people I invited, and 18 showed up for a meeting. And I laid all my cards on the table, and I said, you know, we've succeeded in breeding so many of these cranes that had never reproduced before in captivity, and we have all these international programs, and they were so supportive. 18 of those people joined our board, 15 of those people joined our board of directors that July when we had that meeting, and they said, of course, what we need to do is to have a new site. You were leasing the property of the Sowies for $1 a year since 1973. Well, the rent was right, but you never owned it. And if you want to build substantial facilities, you have to have that type of security of owning your own land. So within a year, we had bought our new site and raised money to pay for it and started the planning for our whole new Crane Foundation. So what started as the Cranium at Cornell evolved into the Crane Breeding Center at the Sowie Farm that went through a terrible pandemic. And from that, from the ashes of that pandemic, rose the new Crane Foundation on a clean site, all of our birds clean, and we've moved on from there. So it's sort of a metaphor maybe for our COVID-19 situation today, although this has been a terribly difficult time for all of us. Maybe there are wonderful things that we can build from it, like banning the use of wildlife in Asia and Africa for food consumption for fear of catching a disease, and very, very careful monitoring of the international trade of animals and so on, and the idea that we worldwide can all work together in solving a problem, in this case a disease that's affecting humans, but there are other huge issues that we can work on in solving too that are threatening our planet, such as climate change and loss of biodiversity and so on.
We're speaking with Dr. George Archibald, co-founder of the International Crane Foundation and the author of a book called My Life with Cranes, A Collection of Stories. You have made brief mention of the single most famous of all of the cranes with which you have worked, a crane by the name of Tex, a whooping crane. And the story of what you did with Tex became so famous that you were actually invited onto the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson to tell the story. I think we can leave it to our listeners to hear about the story in great detail in your book. But for anybody who does not know about you and Tex, maybe you could at least sketch a summary of your very special relationship with Tex and some of the groundbreaking work that you did with him.
With her.
Her, sorry, yes. I consciously knew that at the outset, and then, but I keep flipping back to Tex being a boy. Tex was a girl, yes.
Well, imprinting or early learning in cranes is very important, and Tex was hatched at the San Antonio Zoo, and her parents were alive when there were only 26 whooping cranes alive in the world. And she was their only offspring that survived because the director raised her in his home. And by the time she grew up, she had no interest in cranes. She was totally fixated on people. She was sent to a government research station where they had more whooping cranes out in Maryland called the Patuxent Wildlife Research Center. And for 10 years, they tried to pair her with a whooping crane unsuccessfully. And then I wrote a proposal that I would work with this person as her surrogate mate because she liked humans more than cranes. And she came to the Crane Foundation in 1975, laid one egg a year, but every year something would happen to that egg. It would either be infertile through artificial insemination of imported semen, or it would be addled, or the embryo would die. Finally, in 1982, we had an egg that hatched. She would only lay one egg a year. After 2 months of working with that bird from March, April, into late May, almost 3 months. And that would be dawn till dark in a shack on a hill in the grassland. I had my typewriter and my radio and my book. And she was outside, and I danced with her whenever she wanted. And she and I had this territory. She would attack people who approached our shack. But if wild sandhill cranes landed in the field, she would ignore them because they're only cranes and she doesn't care about them. So we hatched this chick in early June of 1982. And on the 21st of June, I was invited on the Tonight Show to tell the story. And just hours before I went on that show, during the night, Tex was killed by a band of raccoons. So I received that news just before, you know, maybe 10 hours before the show was taped. But I realized that the timing of this whole thing was sort of supernatural. So I had faith that it was meant to be and went on the show, and you can watch it on YouTube. Anyway, Gee Whiz, the name of the chick, grew up to be a handsome male and is now the father of 30 and the great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather of more than 100 cranes.
Incredible.
So the genes have gone on through my dance with ticks.
By the way, you mention in more than one point in the book that at least for most species of cranes, the females and the males appear pretty much to be identical on sight. And you recount at least a couple of different instances in which a well-meaning zoo or conservancy would have housed together two cranes that they mistakenly believed were a male and a female, and they turned out to be actually two males or two females, and that often it is through their dance or through their song that one can actually determine with more clarity and accuracy the actual gender of a given crane.
Yes, they have a duet they do, and during the duet, the male is the alto and the female is the soprano. And they have completely different vocalizations, beautifully synchronized into a single trumpeting call that proclaims their territory for miles and also confirms their pair bond.
Hmm. One of the most extraordinary facets of your work has been that it has taken you all over the world to Afghanistan, India, Russia, China, the demilitarized zone of Korea. And again, in your book, My Life with Cranes, A Collection of Stories, we can read about the many encounters that you have had in all these different parts of the world. One of the things you talk about is that it is no small matter to go to another country and to try to bring about beneficial change on behalf of the cranes there that might be endangered. And it is, in a sense, a delicate dance. Tell us more about what you have learned over the experience over the years in terms of how one best does that in other places.
Well, first you have to go where the cranes are, and then you have to meet key people in that country and develop friendships with them. After all, it's their country, it's their cranes, and my philosophy is how can we help our colleagues over there do what has to be done? And our time is always limited, but one of the important things we do is raise money through grants to support our colleagues in the developing world with small grants often to do very important things. And there are dedicated people like those that work at the Crane Foundation around the world. And if we can be a catalyst in helping these people become effective, that is a very, very important goal to achieve because we are very limited and we are outsiders and we always have to consider ourselves as guests that are very, very interested in your country. And sometimes we say, oh, aren't the cranes beautiful? And they'll look at them through new eyes. They never realized they were rare, that this is the only place they can find these birds. And they see them through different light and really want to do something. And then training people, helping people to go to graduate school to develop the skills they need to do the work they have to do has been one of our priorities. And we're very grateful to the University of Wisconsin and the Nelson Institute there of Environmental Studies and to other universities that have helped in that manner. Yeah, and it's not only a biological, hydrological thing, it's a sociological thing, helping countries develop crane festivals to celebrate the cranes, working in schools, doing micro-lending to impoverished people that live near the wetlands used by the cranes. All of those things are sociological issues, and we bring in people with expertise in those fields, too. Hmm. So it's very complicated, very unique for each circumstance, but it's basically based on key people.
Hmm. I wonder if we could finish. We have about 3 minutes for you to recount one of my favorite stories in the book, which takes place in China. It's a story that you call Abigail's Tears. This is the name Abigail refers to someone named Abigail Avery, who was a member of your team working in China at this point. Could you tell our listeners about this really moving moment?
It was 1985, and the wintering ground of the Siberian Crane had been discovered in 1981, but we had never been there, to this remote lake in China. And I took a group of 15 people, including Abigail Avery, an elderly woman from Lincoln, Massachusetts. Elderly in years, but youthful in mind and strong in body. And we got to this remote area, and I said to my Chinese colleagues, well, what's our plan for the morning? Where are we going to go? Because this is a vast lake, 150 miles long. And they said, well, you're the expert. The people who had discovered the cranes were back in Beijing. They were not able to join us. And so I didn't have a clue where to go. So the next morning, the whole entourage were like 40 people, including press. We went out and walked through the mud, and I saw this point of land way in the distance, and I said, well, let's walk there along the sandy beach because the lake had dropped down, creating these little winter ponds and lakes where the birds were feeding, but we didn't see any cranes. But we got to that point of land, and I could hear the faint calls of cranes. And I told the whole group, get in a line, and we're going to go on our hands and knees up this very steep, grassy bank and look over the other side. So we all crawled up the bank, looked over the other side, and there were 1,400 Siberian cranes in the most beautiful sunlight. The mist was dispelling. It was actually churning as the sun drove through it. And we spent the whole afternoon there, but Abigail was so overcome by emotion that she was weeping. And I said, now, pull it together, Abigail. We've got to count these cranes before they fly away. So we did that. And that night, one of the reporters asked Mrs. Avery, why did you cry when you saw the cranes? And she said, well, my husband passed away a year ago, and he was on the board of the Crane Foundation, and he would have been so happy to see this. So I had some sadness, but I also had great joy that there weren't only a few hundred Siberian cranes, there were 1,000 more than we ever dreamed there would be.
Hmm.
And I was so happy that I cried with happiness, too. And these little Chinese ladies, wonderful ladies, were taking notes, and they wrote this story. Elderly woman from Boston comes to China and helps discover 1,000 cranes that were not known to exist.
Hmm.
And she was overwhelmed with joy and sadness about her husband and shed tears. And there are several things in the Chinese culture that are very important. One are elderly people. They're greatly respected. And second, the number 1,000, it's sort of a lucky number. And then cranes. Cranes are symbols of long life and good luck and happiness in China. So all of those things converged through Abigail Avery. And at her obituary many years later, I said, or at her funeral, I said, Abigail's tears likely did more good for crane and wetland conservation in China for a long period of time, much more than our research.
Mm.
So she was one of those great heroes whose relationship I'll always cherish.
And that story is just one of many in your wonderful book called My Life with Cranes, A Collection of Stories. And more information about the extraordinary work of the International Crane Foundation can be found at their website, which is savingcranes.org. And I'm so glad that just a couple days after what is Whooping Crane Awareness Day, May 18th, we were able to record this conversation. Dr. George Archibald, It was a real privilege and honor for me to speak with you. Thank you for all the great work that you have done, and thank you for sharing so generously about your life and experiences on The Morning Show today. Best wishes to you.
Well, thank you very, very much, Greg, and I hope we can talk together again sometime. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, from the archives, David France, co-author of the definitive book about the AIDS crisis, a book called How to Survive a Plague, the inside story of how citizens and science tamed AIDS. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The